Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a Retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. It's our first episode of 2025. I'm excited to kick off this year. Looking forward to a great year. Learning about retina and talking about retina with you. We're going to talk about the January 2025 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online and in print at retinalphysician.com. This month's episode focuses on home OCT, intraoperative OCT, and the discussion of the importance of Ang-2 in addition to VEGF inhibition for diabetic macular edema and neovascular age-related macular degeneration. Thanks again to Drs. Safa Rahmani and Sarwar Zahid for joining me for this episode. Listeners, I just wanted to add a note. You know, we did a terrific episode with Claire Colley at JD regarding private equity that released back in December 2024. I received a lot of feedback for that episode and just wanted to share a little bit of it anonymously at the requests of those who submitted feedback. One piece of feedback that was submitted was Claire had talked about non-competes not being enforceable and the question of whether they would not be enforceable in situations where somebody is a small piece of a larger venture such as a PE company. And you know, many physicians actually wrote in saying they had been in situations where enforceability had come into question, it became a legal battle. And I think there's kind of two different questions here. I guess one question would be, what would ultimately be decided in the court of law? And then the second question is, could someone still engage you in a legal battle or dissuade an employer from hiring you? And you know, these are practical concerns. I mean, this is one of the reasons we have these episodes is there are doctors out there, young doctors who don't really want to be thinking about this, but unfortunately being forced to think about this more and more as they enter into employment agreements. But anyway, I just want to bring up that point. The other point, and this is a point regarding public ownership of private companies. This was sent by one of the listeners who remained anonymous, and I'll just read it in quotes. Beginning, quote, "Thank you for having Claire Colley at JD regarding private equity. It was helpful. However, I want to point out one area where she is wrong or might be surprised herself with the following. With the sale of RCA to Cencora, which is a publicly traded pharmaceutical distribution company, those Class A and B shares does not turn into Cencora shares. Physicians cannot invest into Cencora. Sensora. These shares are reinvested with another subsidiary associated with Sensora that is private and not publicly traded. So this sale to a publicly traded company is not technically a quote unquote good thing, as mentioned in the episode, or rather a way to keep things within RCA and quote unquote no out for physicians by seeing the benefits of having a rollover of the shares to publicly traded shares. I don't even know what to say about this. This is why business education should be an important part of medical school curriculum. Given current medical business climate, aka corporate medicine, these terminologies and transactions, if not understood, can lead to physicians becoming lame ducks for these corporate medicine organizations where physicians will get abused. Once again, I want to remain anonymous. And one other point that was made was regarding some of the details regarding the sale shared by this physician. You know, and again, I have no stake or inside knowledge of what's going on at the RCA Centaurus sale. This is not to share anything regarding that. This is just the opinion of one listener sharing it as listener mail. But again, this is a hot topic. I think we're going to hear more and more about this. And I think that I would just say my advice for all of you out there is just, you know, always be careful. It doesn't matter whether you're going to an agreement with an organization owned by physicians or an organization owned by a hospital, organization owned by a insurance company, or an organization owned by a private equity company. You do, unfortunately, have a responsibility to read the details, be a good colleague, but also reinforce what you are willing and willing not to do and what is kind of written in the contract. And these are the sort of the soft skills that we don't learn in medical school for most of our mentors and most of the educational system. And hopefully, again, we continue to develop these skills in younger doctors at an earlier age so they can better function in a world that's getting increasingly complex in terms of business entanglement. So without further ado, here's today's episode. And thank you again for listening. As always, if you ever have feedback, please feel free to share. And sometimes we'll share those listener thoughts here on the podcast. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the January 2025 edition of Retinal Physician. Yes, we made it to 2025. Retinal Physician, as you all know, published online and in print. You can find it at retinalphysician.com. And joining me for this episode two of my favorite retina specialists from around the country. First, Dr. Safa Rahmani, who's in Chicago. Safa, happy New Year. How are you?
Thank you for having me, Jay.
And Dr. Sarwar Zahid in New York. Sarwar, you dropping the ball tonight?
I'm not dropping the ball, but I'm DJing a party, so happy New Year. I'm about to drop some beats, break some beats, DJ Skeezus. You know how we do.
I think it's funny that we say dropping the ball is a good thing, but it's only a good thing on New Year's. Every other time, dropping the ball is a bad thing. Anyway, we have a few articles. Three of them are about OCT, and the last one's about Ang2. But let's talk about it. So the first article, again, the goal here, I'm just going to summarize key points, and then you can go read these articles if you'd like, if you're listening, and then we're going to use them to discuss here. Anat Lowenstein and Matt McCumber wrote this article called "The Potential Impact of Home OCT on Neovascular AMD Management," and this is a topic we've talked about before, and Dr. Lowenstein has talked about before. But essentially, one of the big takeaways is we get a lot of information from OCT today, but one of the things we don't get is time. We get time as a function of a sawtooth. We see patients at intervals at 1 month or 2 months or 3 months, whatever interval you see them. And you can see what the OCT is. But very much like intraocular pressure for glaucoma specialists, we don't have real-time continuous monitoring. So obviously, a workable and reliable home OCT model would change a lot of things for us as retina specialists. And so they talk about how this could be useful at different stages. And the three stages they talk about is at the beginning, when you start wet AMD treatment, when you start deciding how to extend, and finally, when you finally maintain. And the last thing they'll talk about, can you stop therapy? And I think that there's useful points at each point. Early stages is very useful, right? So if you can see a patient is really not responding, maybe that would change how you conduct step therapy is one of their arguments. For example, if you give patient Avastin or an off-label agent or a biosimilar or something that maybe your step therapy is mandating, but they're not responding at peak effect, which is 1 or 2 weeks, which is earlier than you'd see them, then maybe you could make an argument to switch therapies earlier. Conversely, you may know earlier you don't have to switch therapies if they're responding really, really well. In terms of extension, they talk about, again, we're extending sort of by guessing the treat and extend. You could say educated guessing, 1 or 2 week intervals, but maybe you could extend more aggressively. If you had home OCT, you probably could extend more aggressively. And many of our patients we know, especially with the newer second generation anti-VEGF agents, probably could go longer than a 6 week or 8 week extension. They probably could go 2, 3, 4, even 4 months, but you don't know which of those patients are which. And you don't want to take the chance of a problem, so we end up walking them out. So home OCT would allow you to be more aggressive potentially and more certain with your treat and extend. And then finally, the maintenance and the potential stop therapy would be if you have a patient, you may be more willing to stop therapy if they can do home OCT monitoring cheaply and effectively at home. It makes you more likely to try because you're not going to lose them for weeks after recurrence. Maybe you pick up a recurrence right away when it happens and they'd come in for treatment. So, Sava, I mean, I think I'll say two things about this. I think number one, none of this is surprising. I think that we all agree that home OCT would be extremely helpful. And I think the second point, they don't really talk about implementation. And there's been some early studies. Dr. Lowenstein talked about home treatment and her experience in Israel during COVID in separate articles. But implementation is going to be the biggest part of it, right? So, like, what do the devices cost? How does the patient acquire this image? Like, these are the things that would have been maybe more interesting to talk about here. I know it's not the purpose of the article, but I don't think any of us would disagree that home OCT would change a lot of the paradigms for how we treat any patient who gets injections.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm really excited about getting the new information from this sort of time perspective, because there's so much unknown, and I think it can really change our paradigms once we have more information about, what's happening with all these agents, individualized patient, and again, the theme of individualized medicine. This is really kind of key to that. So I think before we kind of talk about all the implementation, it is really helpful to at least, look at the science and say, okay, this is how it's going to improve patient outcomes, really potentially even change how many injections patient get based on, how they're responding. But I think, as you mentioned, there are two things that can be that need to be really taken in consideration is patient adherence long term, because I think everybody will be excited to do it at the beginning and really stick to it. And then and how do we get paid for it? How do we get patients to get this machine? Is it going to be insurance? Are different insurances going to have, coverage for this? But we won't get people on board without the science. So I think it's reasonable to start there and see, look, this is how the science is going to change patient outcomes and management and go from there.
Yeah, and Sarwar, I'm not gonna bury the lead, but I think it's worth kind of mentioning the next article before you give your thoughts, because Christina Wang wrote a retina conversation with Jim Gallagher, who's the editor of Retina Physician. Christina, friend of the podcast, very well known from Baylor. And she's talking about Protocol AO because she's the national protocol chair. And Protocol AO is DRCR's protocol looking at home OCT and its implementation. And she talks about some of this in that article. She talks about how there are codes that you can bill with, right? She talks about that patient adherence was a concern, but that Nodal Vision, which is the company that makes the home OCT they're studying in AO, it, of course, they have an incentive to want patients to adhere. So they're going to take care of a lot of that. So it doesn't fall on the physician. And they talk about Protocol AK, which was the pilot study where patients would scan an average of 6+ times a week, which is basically almost every day. Maybe they take Sunday off. I don't know. And it's not a big time burden and people are able to do it. So it, one of the things I think about is it has been here, right? Like there's codes now, there's home OCT. As Safa said, is it just that people, I find, and this is my anecdotal experience, people, I've had mixed reviews when people have used Nodal Vision. I've not used it myself in any institution or practice I've been at, but people who have used it have been sort of mixed on like how it implements with their EMR and how that implements with their flow and how workable it is. Any thoughts? Now bring in Christina's article and how the DRCR is going to look at this, and also adding to what Safa said about what will make people want to use home OCT more.
Yeah, I think these are both great articles that sort of remind us sort of the changes that are coming in the horizon with home OCT. This article, Christina Wang's article is great because it, really demonstrates, the thoughtfulness to Protocol AO. So I think we'll get some great insights on it. The hard part is, setting up with any new technology is setting up the workflow, right? I mean, I think I haven't used the home OCT technology myself, but like how are we going to do this? Are we going to dedicate half a day? Similarly, I mean, this is similar to looking at using AI generated, call a retina specialist or like have a retina specialist review this image because it's been flagged. Are we going to have dedicated time to review these images? If it's reimbursed, of course. I mean, our time is valuable, so I think there have to be infrastructures for that. But I think part of the reason that things it's hard to implement some of these things is it takes a lot of work on the front end to set up the infrastructure. Like, for example, the way I would envision a home OCT situation is like, okay, I'm going to have one day a week where I'm going to spend the time looking at anything that's been flagged. And that's, that's more than, that should be adequate. But, it's in private practice versus academic settings, like that we have to have good support systems in order to allow us to
Right.
build these things. The other thing that I really loved in Anat Lowenstein's article is she mentioned that fluid recurrence may not be exactly periodic. And I love that phrasing because I think that sort of really encapsulates the variability in patients. I mean, we've all had patients that are stable at 8 weeks and but then all of a sudden they recur at 6 weeks. And that's it's helpful for those specific recurrences. The other thing is we've all picked up, it's like, oh my God, look at the other eye. Because I think a lot of us get OCTs in both eyes. It's like, oh, whoa, hold up. What's this fluid in the other eye? And we pick up new conversions. So I think that's really interesting. The last point I'll make is I'm kind of excited about using this in other technologies. And I think, there's like, for example, in diabetics, I mean, I use a lot of steroid. Imagine, you have a well. We've all seen those diabetics and retinal vein occlusion patients where you get that nice drying, right? And we'll have to come up with the algorithms, because I think the algorithms for fluid and DME is a little bit different because, it's much more multifocal, and there may be a hard exudate. So, we'll have to develop the technology. It's like, okay, are we like, for example, I have patients coming in at like 14 weeks, and it's like they're still dry. I mean, honestly, if that patient were home, if I saw a home OCT where their retina looked dry, I would have been like, what, come back another 3 weeks. I don't think you need another OZURDEX at this point. The last thing is, whenever there's a new technology, I always get frustrated because with a big managed Medicaid population, I know getting that stuff approved with some of these Medicare Advantage programs is going to be another practice burden. So I would hope that either the company or ASRS would help us facilitate to ameliorate some of this burden.
Yeah, great points. And Safa, I think the implementation and the work stream, like you could imagine, and again, I don't want to be cynical, but you can imagine if the finances made sense for practices or institutions, you could easily have a physician dedicated simply to reviewing flags every day. It's just when you think of the financial opportunity cost of that versus a physician seeing patients in clinic and also just the shortage of retina specialists. It really becomes a question. Don't then, and then there's all sorts of scope questions, right? We can't, don't have to get into, but in Star Wars, ears are pricked up because theoretically you could
get someone who's a non-physician who's trained to look at this. And then finally, you could have an AI algorithm or computer do the flagging and scheduling for you at some point if you ever validated it. But it's interesting. And not to belabor OCT, and again, we've mentioned on the podcast before the difference with OCT's codes kind of being cut. And they reference that that's one of the potential challenges, right? Is that if you make home OCT reimbursed, but you also make it something you do at home, maybe in-office OCT continues to get cut. Honestly, it may happen regardless of whether home OCT picks up. But this next article is about intraoperative OCT. Sid Sheckett was the senior author with his team. And again, I don't want to belabor things we've talked about in the past. People have listened to the podcast in the past. I think we've had an article at least once a year on intraoperative OCT. It doesn't mean it's not important, and it's an important subject, but I feel that there's been very slow and gradual movement in terms of how we use it. But they go through a lot of the indications, that you would expect, in terms of VRMs, macular holes, seeing interfaces. I think it has a special use, especially in some complex macular hole cases where you want to look, for example, as an autograft or amniotic membrane. And then, what about for patients with buckling? I thought the buckling thing was particularly interesting. They talked about scleral buckling with real-time OCT and how you sort of adjust it based on intraoperative OCT. It felt a little bit like using the Aura for toric lenses. I don't know if you need to adjust every buckle with intraoperative OCT, but I want to be open-minded. Maybe it would improve our ability to place buckles in the right place in the right spot. Safa, do you use intraoperative OCT at all? Do you have access to it? I mean, we have it here. I feel we break it out once in a blue moon to look at something, but I feel it almost never changes our management yet.
No, I do have access, and I have access to both at the Children's Hospital and the Adult Hospital. I have found it more challenging to kind of implement it in my regular practice. We use it for very special occasions, and I think personally, I find it very distracting, and I rely, sort of on the what I'm seeing more than anything else. And I think it certainly has a role, and I'm excited as the technology develops. But I think the kind of the challenges that the article kind of went through is not insignificant. So the incompatibility of the technology with various scopes, the image quality, the variety in image quality is actually really, really important. And that has been the biggest sort of hindrance for me to sort of include it in my daily practice, because that image quality can change so dramatically based on nuances. And you have to be aware of how to adjust those nuances. The techs have to know, the OR team has to know. And if you bring it out once in a while, nobody can keep up with these nuances. And this is such a important technology in terms of how you work with it. So from an intraoperative standpoint, I think we have a lot of work to do, but I'm excited for this to be part of a seamless, transition. I do think that we'll get there. I don't think we're there yet. I think it's easier in heads-up displays. I certainly use the handheld OCT all the time in children. And again, all these nuances of how to hold, how to do this, what to do,
Right.
the position, all those become critical in surgery. And I feel like there's so many other things going on during surgery that if that's not automatically optimized for you, then it can really sort of derail. They made a lot of good points about how it kind of changed management during surgery, but they didn't actually mention whether it actually improved patient outcomes,
Right,
So
right.
changing management is different than, changing patient outcomes, So the 100% of buckles, all those, does it change the
It
outcomes?
changed their reattachment rates. Yeah. Usually when people don't report something, it means it probably didn't, the change wasn't there. I don't know anything about that article. I gotta go read it. Maybe they didn't even look at it, but I always am curious whenever I see a paper that has a very obvious question that was not addressed at any point. I'm always just curious if it was omitted because they didn't see a significant difference and it didn't fit the narrative of the paper, so you don't report it. Like, I don't know what you think, Sarah. Not to pick on that paper, but I think that's a great point, Safa, about what are you adding value to? Are you adding value to the physician, which is important? Are you decreasing operative time, which is important? Are you changing, like Safa said, the outcome? Or is it a one-off thing where occasionally in complex cases it adds value? Because that's going to change Sarah, the marketability and whether ASC in the middle of the country is going to buy it versus academic center, tertiary referral center that has pediatric cases, complex cases going to do it. So I haven't seen much really move the needle yet in terms of something that said definitively, or the technology saying, like, this is a breakthrough, you have to switch.
Definitely exciting technology. I agree. I also agree that getting ASCs to invest in a piece of equipment that doesn't demonstrably reduce operative time or maybe reimburse more simply because of the way the economics works is going to be a challenge. And I mean, I think just, as a side note, there are new surgical machines that are coming out, vitrectomy machines that are coming out in the next couple of years. And, I want to play with all the toys, right? But, it's hard to get an ASC to make that investment if what we have currently gets the job done. I liked the suggestion that we are working on instruments. I actually haven't used intraoperative OCT, but I like the idea of not having to stop and scan and having something, not in the way of your surgical instrumentation, so you don't have to stop and then scan and then resume your, that just sounds inefficient. The other
But
thing is.
they've been talking about that idea now, I feel, for a few years, but we still don't have instruments on the market
Yeah, we don't.
cooperate. They're all prototypes.
Yeah, we don't have them. That's one. And the other thing is like to add to some of the discussion about like, okay, does it improve in outcome? Like some of the studies with ERM and Mac Hole, they compared, using the intraoperative OCT versus, ERM and ILM peeling. Like the studies show that there's anatomically similar outcomes. Like presumably there's an implication that if we're using a technology that helps us make safer grabs of the retinal tissues, then we're able to be safer or more atraumatic. I mean, I think to truly confirm that, I'd want to know, are there less little divots on the ILM, when, if you're using intraoperative OCT in a larger study? Furthermore, like it would be cool to see, like, all right, you know what? I'm going to not peel ILM. I'm going to use intraoperative OCT, and then I'm going to stain with Brilliant Blue. And then how am I more likely to be automatically peeling the ILM simply based on what I'm seeing on the OCT to reduce the need for ILM peeling? So some of these things in future studies would really demonstrate some value and add to the fact that there's a safety margin and, things that are quantifiable.
Yeah, I agree. This last article has nothing to do with the first three, which is often the case when we do these previews. So I apologize. This one's about Ang2, and they have this section called Controversies of Care and Care, which Michael Colicello does a great job putting together. And this one is called "Is There Convincing Evidence That Ang2 Suppression Confers a Clinical Benefit?" Which is a very spicy title. I will preface, and this is no criticism of Dr. Colicello, Dr. Khanani, or Dr. Lim, who wrote this article. I was a little disappointed that there was no actual argument in this article, that unless I missed it. And the reason I say that, to summarize, is that usually people take opposing sides, right? Someone writes yes and someone writes no, and they defend it. And maybe it's kind of like when the academy does debates, it may be a little formulaic, but it actually leads to some interesting thoughts because each person sort of references the different things. The interesting part here is they both sort of said the same thing. Dr. Khanani gave evidence and talked about how there was benefits in clinical trials and the real world with Ang2 and VEGF inhibition at the same time. So then I went to the next one expecting Dr. Lim to say the opposite, but then she said the same thing. She said that there's faster drying on imaging, which both are true. But I would just say this, and again, I read all these. I talked to a lot of people nationwide. There may be some basic science evidence that Ang2 inhibition helps, and I do think that it probably matters in some patients. It is extremely hard to separate that out from the higher molar concentration of VEGF-A and faricimab versus the older anti-VEGF agent. So I agree it's unfair to label it an anti-VEGF agent when it has dual mechanism. It is a bispecific antibody. Genentech is right to advertise it as such. I just would have liked not to be Monday morning quarterback at the end of the year, beginning of the year, to see a little more back and forth, because I think the argument from retina specialists across the country, when you go and talk to them on the ground, is that I use it, but don't keep talking to me about Ang2 because I'm not sure that's why this works better. It simply could be a molar concentration issue. And Safa, we may not know the answer ever if we never see a head-to-head between high dose of aflibercept and faricimab. And the next generation is not souped up VEGF-As. They're all like TKIs, things that are adjuvants. So we may not know for a long time, but I just would have liked a little more of the other side being like, well, actually, yes, we don't know 100% for sure it's the Ang2, even though there are suggestions that it may help.
No, I agree. I was looking for it. I was like, I'm not getting the controversy here in terms of what what you usually see. And I agree. I think unless that there's a head-to-head study with high dose of aflibercept and faricimab, like we're not going to know that answer, But I do think that in a certain set of population, a certain set of patients, again, coming back to personalized care, it does make a difference. There's enough basic science to sort of suggests that there's something going on and that it is making a difference, but we won't know unless there's a head-to-head study, and it will be, I don't think that will ever happen. That's just my opinion.
So, were you expecting more spice here?
I'm always expecting spice. I'm used to, we're used to like the VBS pro and con debates. But I think the what was nice about the article is that, like there was some data that I wasn't familiar with. I mean, I didn't know that some of the other studies showed that, just some of the anti-VEGF agents themselves reduce Ang-2 activity. So, I mean, I think that's, it adds nuance to our understanding. I think we've all reviewed some of these studies before, but it was nice to review that in a lot of studies there is a reduction in the vascular permeability on angiogram, which may contribute to some. And there was data presented at ASRS last year, so comparing at least Eylea 2 milligrams with the faricimab at the equivalent time points, showing reduced vascular leakage on angiogram. So it's suggesting that that may be the reason that there's better anatomic outcomes. I mean, like in all honesty, what I really want to see, and I think there are studies that are go under being done right now, is that the clinical relevance of some of these, sorry, the clinical applicability of some of these studies is still lacking. I mean, I think we all have patients. I mean, everyone that I talk to says, yeah, it works great to dry the retina in AMD patients, but I still need to use it Q4 to 5 weeks for a much longer period of time with faricimab before I'm able to extend, and I think that just goes to show. And I think I want to know how some of these things are contributed, how the ongoing poor glycemic control in a lot of patients with poorer glycemic control plays that role, and I think, there's some would say that, like if you hammer on with Avastin for long enough, eventually either the disease dies out on you or burns out on you, or, it eventually starts to work,
Yeah, I think that this goes back maybe to bring it full circle to the conversation about home OCT. Is I think that we have simplified our understanding in order to make it feasible to see lots of patients and take care of lots of patients. But as you pointed out, Sarwar, and you both did, it's a lot more complicated, and especially DME is probably a lot more complicated. And that's it's interesting, all the home OCT stuff, we didn't really mention this, was for AMD, neovascular AMD. I wonder with DME if it would ever be workable, because there's so much fluctuation in fluid with DME. And maybe we would end up overcalling things and bringing patients too early, when we've all seen patients with fluid that gets better and that gets worse. And it's probably tied to many things systemically that are going on, versus we like to think of wet AMD as more isolated, even though it's not truly isolated. And I think the same thing is true here when you're talking about Ang-2, VEGF, all these things. It's like so simple to think about people as responder, non-responder, incomplete responder. Like it's easier, and it makes it, you can see a lot of patients if you just sort of keep it simple and move forward. But in reality, we don't fully understand all the reasons that some patients respond to medication, some doesn't. And I think faricimab, Safa, I'll give you the last word before we break. Faricimab has sort of outlined sort of our lack of understanding with some of these situations, where it's good in a way, it's revealing what we don't know. But anecdotally, we've had some patients who are slam dunks and some patients where it doesn't seem to do much more than the previous generation. And I have yet to found any sort of consistent pattern, and there's no data suggesting yet a consistent pattern, which patients tend to respond. Which ones who were non-responders, incomplete responders before, tend to respond to faricimab, which ones don't? I haven't seen any sort of pattern or published pattern yet. And that would be something interesting in the future to better understand, because maybe you could just throw your hands up and just be like, well, we'll never fully understand everything. And some people respond to some medications, some don't. But there's got to be something on an antibody level, and also at the receptor level, for why some patients are more likely to have a positive response to faricimab, and why some it just doesn't look any different than older anti-VEGF agent.
No, I think those are great points to kind of think about. And I think the more that we use faricimab, the more real world data we're going to be able to find. I think, once it was approved, most people, changed, at least I know I did, sort of my treatment recalcitrant patients in both DME and for AMD. And now, we're all just starting to use faricimab as first agent here and there. But obviously, depending on insurance and various other factors. And I think as we go along and we treat a more sort of dynamic set of patients, we may have more answers to this. But I agree, I think DME is going to be much harder because of there's so much variability even within the patient, even within all the systemic sort of comorbidities that goes with DME. I think it's going to be much, much harder to tease that out. It may be a little bit easier as we go with AMD, but I think DME is going to be a much tougher call. But the more we use it in a more general population, now that it's, in more frequent use, I think we'll get more answers.
I appreciate both of you kicking off 2025 on this podcast with me. Appreciate all you guys do. Have a great New Year's. Be safe. Dr. Ramani, Dr. Zahid, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Sharon. Happy New Year.
Many thanks to Dr. Zahid and Ramani for joining us for this episode. And remember, listeners, it's been eight and a half years almost. It's been pretty wild. There's 453 episodes, including today's episode, on our website, retinapodcast.com. We love doing this. I really think sometimes people ask how long we're going to keep doing this for. When I started, I said 3 years, and then it became 5 years, and now we're still going. And I'll be honest, that there are times where I wonder if we are burning out of topics, and then things happen in the world of retina and we have more to discuss. So thanks for listening. Thanks for checking in our social media page. Thanks for looking at our posts on Twitter and on Facebook at Retina Podcast, and for sending us feedback and episode ideas to retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to our whole production team, especially Dr. Justin Ma, who has just been a absolute warrior in terms of getting these episodes done, working around my crazy schedule and making sure that we get these episodes out in time. Thanks to you, listeners. Congratulations on making through another wonderful year. We're excited to do this year. ASRS will be in my backyard here in the West Coast, so hope to see a lot of you here, as well as the Bitbuckle Society meeting in March. A lot to look forward to as we move in 2025. So thank you for all you do for your patients and for the next generation of retina specialists. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.